The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, March 14th, 2021. Yes, it's Pi Day here on the Wrestling Podcast of Numbers. This week, we'll talk about ratings. We'll talk about pay-per-view buys. We'll talk about explosions. WrestleMania at Raymond James Stadium. Looks like they're going to try to pack them in. The NHL has made a deal with ESPN. What does that mean for the future of wrestling TV rights fees? WWE's proxy statement still has not come out. Maybe next week. I've got stuff written at WrestleNomics.com. I've got a YouTube video. YouTube. This is the beginning of my midlife crisis, I think. I'm a YouTuber now. First it was Twitch, now this. All that coming up in the hour. But first, AEW Dynamite, coming off of its, what looks to be, we'll talk about it later, its most in-demand pay-per-view yet. But AEW Dynamite on the Wednesday following the Revolution pay-per-view, coming in with a disappointing number, although the program did rank number 4 on the night in P18-49. But 743,000 viewers for the post-pay-per-view event. Usually Dynamite episodes following a pay-per-view mean a moderate increase versus the median of the last 4 episodes. Not this time. Viewership was slightly down by that comparison on this occasion. 743,000 viewers, 441,000 of those viewers between the ages of the coveted 18 to 49 bracket. Opposing AEW Dynamite on Wednesday night, WWE NXT on the USA Network with a number of title matches in the 2-hour program. 691,000 viewers, the fewest since February 10th. Dynamite's viewership also was the fewest since February 10th. NXT ranked number 25 in the key demo of 18 to 49. That's the equivalent of about 233,000 viewers. Raw and SmackDown both had pretty normal ratings compared to what they've been doing lately. Fast Nationals for SmackDown on this Friday. Looks like SmackDown is a little bit down, but we'll see what happens when the finals are reported on Monday. Monday Night Raw swept the top 3 spots in 18 to 49 on Monday on cable once again. Impact Wrestling on Access ranked 117th. That's roughly in the range of what they've been doing. Maybe that's a little bit on the high end. Nonetheless, total viewership of 144,000 viewers was down 11% compared to what they do normally. Raw and SmackDown, by the way, exceed these other 3 programs by a wide, wide margin. Last week, Friday, SmackDown doing 2.25 million viewers, almost 2.3 million viewers. Raw doing 1.9 million viewers. And I believe it was some jabroni analyst who told you, the listener, earlier in this year or at the end of last year, to watch what happens in not just the 18 to 49 demo, but the 18 to 34 demo, the younger adult demo. Watch what happens. Compare that demo, the trends over time of Dynamite in that demo to Raw in that demo, and what's been happening since then. In the last few months, Raw is doubling AEW Dynamite in that demo, more or less so far in the first 3 months of 2021. It was getting pretty close there at the end of 2020. Raw's lead over AEW in 18 to 34 was down to as little as 32%, 24%. You know, just a 32% lead in August and September, a 24% in December when AEW did some really strong programs with high viewership. Since then, Raw has taken the lead or increased its lead, I should say, doubling, more than doubling, AEW in January, a lead of 86% in February, a lead of 120% in March at this point. So while through the pandemic, we were trending toward a smaller and smaller margin for Raw over Dynamite, that trend has not continued yet so far in 2021. On the other hand, yes, AEW's lead over NXT in every demo, except for good old P50+, has been quite decisive. In the all TV is down crisis category, we are now looking at the trailing 13 weeks of each program, taking the median of those 13 weeks. Why 13 weeks? That's about one quarter of a year. That's arbitrary, but seems like a good, I don't know, section of time to grab the last 13 weeks. Take the median out of those 13. Compare the median that you get from that to the same 13 weeks of the year prior. So it's important to compare one time of the year to the same time of the prior year because of seasonal effects. But anyway, TV overall, we're going to use, again, the top 50 non-news cable programs. Total viewership is down 21%. Everybody else is doing a little bit better right now. Raw comes the closest to that benchmark, down 19%. And the next worst by that comparison, Impact Wrestling, down 16%, followed by AEW Dynamite, down 12%. And then SmackDown, down just 8%, and NXT, down just 4%. So NXT appears to be the most enduring on this occasion in this measurement. But what about, that was total audience only. What about 18 to 49, the key demo, the demo that sells the ads? Top 50 non-news cable is down 29% in 18 to 49, median of the last 13 versus the median of the 13 weeks in the same year prior. Does that make sense? I hope everybody's following me here. Down 29%. If you're doing worse than 29%, you're in trouble. But nobody's doing worse than 29%. But what's the results here? Who's the closest to doing that bad? NXT is the closest to doing that bad. Down 27%. Again, just 2 points away from the 29% of the top 50 non-news cable. Followed by NXT, down 25%. WWE Raw, down 17%. WWE SmackDown, and then a big gap before we get to AEW Dynamite, down just 7% in the 18 to 49 comparison. And Impact Wrestling, we've got some weak precision to use here because I'm using a P18 to 49 demographic rating, which is like 0.04 in a lot of weeks for Impact, and then converting that to viewers. So I would call this an estimate in the case of Impact Wrestling. Really, all these numbers, which are ultimately from Nielsen via Showbiz Daily, are estimates. But that notwithstanding, Impact Wrestling down 5%. Again, while the top 50 non-news cable is all the way down to 29%. So in terms of a crisis, I don't see any of these programs doing terribly. I mean, it is not good that NXT is down to that degree, I guess. But Raw is pretty close as well, and then Raw is dominating right now on Monday nights. I don't think there's much you can say that's that bad about Raw's TV viewership at this moment. SmackDown's viewership has been holding up pretty impressively as well. And then from there, let's get to it. I lay in bed after the conclusion of AEW Revolution 2021. $50 poorer. Staring up at the ceiling. And I concluded the obvious, which I've been in denial about for many years. Pro wrestling is hopeless. The last modicum of faith I had in the creative redemption of this beloved art was finally extinguished on Sunday night. An interference-laden pay-per-view, highlighted by the unveiling of AEW's latest signing, from the 45 plus crowd. Overhyped and underdelivered by the company that promised to be sportslike. Was capped off by one of the most embarrassing moments in pro wrestling history. U.S. pro wrestling will never be good again, if it ever was. Even after we defeat the novel coronavirus, there is a virus infecting pro wrestling. The business will die, not of this virus, no. There will be enough money to go around to keep it alive for a long time to come. This virus is neither deadly enough to kill the business outright, yet it is still innocuous enough to grant some hope. But the creative virus is everywhere, and there is no cure.
God almighty.
What a great night.
And for AEW Revolution on March 7th, it looks to have been AEW's best-selling pay-per-view yet. Selling somewhere in the neighborhood of 125,000 buys, that would exceed what I believe to be the record set with Double or Nothing in May 2020 last year with 105,000 buys. That pay-per-view too in the COVID era, the first pay-per-view in fact of the COVID era for AEW. But this one exceeding that by roughly maybe a little bit more than 20,000 pay-per-view buys. The entire event generated probably more than $5 million gross. A lot of that is going to be taken home by the various pay-per-view providers. But more than $5 million on pay-per-view alone, and then just under 100,000 between ticket sales and merchandise sales. According to the Observer newsletter, there were 1,150 paid fans in attendance at Daly's Place in Jacksonville, Florida, for the pay-per-view event. Of course, that event main evented by the AEW heavyweight title match. Is it a heavyweight anyway? The AEW title match between champion Kenny Omega against Jon Moxley in a barbed wire time bomb, or maybe just barbed wire exploding death match. But over $5 million on pay-per-view gross, the pay-per-view providers will take a little bit more than half of that. AEW probably ends up with a little over $2 million in net revenue. If you figure the event cost around or just under $1 million to run, then this would be a quite profitable show for All Elite Wrestling. You may be seeing some reports of a higher gross that I think is not taking into account the lower price point that the pay-per-view is sold at in international markets, where it's mostly sold at $20 or around $20 in non-US and non-Canada markets, which as far as I know has always been the case. For the ticket sales, if we take an average ticket price of about $65, which is the median of the advertised ticket price range, if we take an average ticket price of $65, the high was the low was $40 and the high was $90, that would end up with a gate of around $75,000. If you figure merch per capita is about $15 per head, I was told it was a little bit higher than that, $18. Let's say that's just over $20,000 in venue merchandise. That's a small fraction of the pay-per-view revenue. But obviously, capacity is limited at this point. So those are the facts, as I know them, related to the Revolution pay-per-view. As far as why the time bomb explosion at the end of the pay-per-view was what it was, what was intended, we'll go to some comments from Tony Khan in a moment. But basically, what it looked like the spot was supposed to emulate was the ending of a 1993 Atsushi Onita versus Terry Funk match in an exploding time bomb death match. Same rules, basically, where after Onita beat Terry Funk, the time bomb hadn't gone off yet and was about to go off. And as it did, Onita ran into the ring and covered and sort of took the hit or helped protect Terry Funk. And then they both rose from the ashes and walked out of the arena or the stadium. This is at Kawasaki Stadium, of course. Walked away from the ring, arm in arm, side by side. So I imagine something similar was intended for the end scene with Eddie Kingston and John Moxley, as they would reunite and become a tag team or something like that, evident from the promos that followed on Dynamite on Wednesday. Nonetheless, as you probably know, the time bomb, which was probably meant to fully engulf the ring in smoke and be this huge explosion, which is what it would be in an Onita match in FMW, was nothing of the sort. There were just some sparklers and a few smaller explosions at ringside. So what was intended? Tony Khan did a more than 30-minute post-show conference call with media where I have to say he looked to be in an incredibly good mood, which I cannot say I would be in such a good mood if I was in his position, where he gave this comment, among others. And oh, by the way, usually WrestleNomics is a family program, but if you're listening with your kids, there are some swear words in this clip.
Two questions. First, is there a way to turn around that explosion? I'm not saying this is how you do it, but maybe by explaining Kingston's friends are backstage.
We're posting now what's going on with the explosion on social media. Have you seen, Justin, the promo that John did at the live event that some of the live fans have posted, but then we're posting it now. It's uploading from like the TV copy. I don't know if you saw what John said after the event.
I didn't. I haven't yet.
Okay. To quote John, or at least paraphrase, if not word for word, Kenny Omega might be a bad son of a bitch, but he can't build an exploding ring worth of shit. Kenny, you know, the plans for this we saw in Crayon, and all through the match we saw, you know, it looked very cool, and it's a very deadly, painful match. But at the end, I mean, I don't know what people really want. Unless you wanted us to actually explode the guys at the end, there's only so much you can do. So without actually blowing the ring and both guys up, I think the basic explanation is that Kenny's ring set to explode, his plan, you know, as a heel who built this thing with a hammer and nails, as we saw, that the final bomb just didn't go off.
So there's Tony Khan almost making it sound as if the explosion that the fans saw at the end of the pay-per-view was the explosion that was intended, which is not my impression of reality. And I know he's sewing in a lot of kayfabe there and giving you the storyline answer of what happened and what they're going to go with, but making comments at the end also, as you just heard, to the effect of, I don't know what you could have expected, we can't blow them up, and things of that nature. Again, allowing one to read, and again, I don't think this is the case, that what happened was what was intended. And I have listened to this entire 30-plus-minute post-show conference call, and there's no further clarification about just what was intended for the end of the show. But it appears that there was supposed to be a much larger explosion that just did not go off as planned. So my hyperbolic review of the show set to Mozart aside, what does the pay-per-view ending this way mean for AEW's business in light of the lack of explosion or the dud? Combine that with, this was AEW's most successful pay-per-view yet. And I think a little bit too, combine that with the lack of explanation to people who spent up to $50 on this, the lack of explanation beyond a storyline explanation. So in short, I think this is a very bad moment for AEW's brand and a bad moment for its goodwill relationship with fans. Is possible to rebuild from this, but it sort of couldn't come at a worse time when you captivated people and got your biggest pay-per-view audience ever. Everybody watching, who was watching legally anyway, paid money to see this, and it didn't deliver in an embarrassing way. As many people say, the match, I think most people are somewhat impressed, at least, by the performance of the match. The match was at a minimum fine, but that last moment at the end, I think, sends a message that I'm not sure if AEW can always deliver what they promise. Maybe if you're also disappointed in Christian being revealed as the mystery new signing, that compounds that perception. And the disappointment response, I think, is bared out in the Wednesday viewership performance of Dynamite, coming in lower than Dynamite has been performing in recent weeks when other post-pay-per-view programs usually meant an increase relative to the previous 4 weeks of AEW Dynamite. So a record on pay-per-view, do people feel burnt? Are people going to come back for Double or Nothing in May? Is AEW going to be able to compete with that record for Double or Nothing? Obviously, it will depend on a number of factors, but one of those factors will be just how the potential pay-per-view audience feels about the ending or the show overall, Revolution. But AEW has a couple months to try to get people to forget and to be captivated again in something else. In other news, we've got reports both from the Wrestling Observer Newsletter and from John Alba, a reporter from Central Florida who's broken a number of wrestling news stories lately, that WWE plans to have 45,000 fans each night at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa Bay, Florida, for WrestleMania, which is a two-day event, on Saturday and Sunday, April 10th and 11th. Capacity of Raymond James Stadium with a full stage and a typical non-COVID times WrestleMania event would be probably somewhere in well in excess of 60,000. 45,000 is reported to be the capacity that they're going to attempt to fill. Tickets not yet on sale. Tickets go on sale Tuesday with less than a month to go before the day of the events. If 45,000 tickets go on sale for each day, that would be a total. This is the math podcast. That would be a total of 90,000 tickets. Is this really going to happen? There's no confirmation yet from WWE that 45,000 each day is really what they intend to do. The Tampa Bay, is it Tampa Bay or Tampa? What's the deal here? Anyway, the Tampa Sports Authority is the organization that oversees Raymond James Stadium. John Alba notes that he's reached out to the Tampa Sports Authority. I have also emailed the Tampa Sports Authority, and no one has gotten a response yet as to what the capacity at Raymond James Stadium will be for WrestleMania. Having a big crowd there for WrestleMania would fit the MO of WWE to be the first to put such a large number of people in attendance and to get back in business, which is the tagline for this year's WrestleMania, back in business. That said, can this be done safely? What are the safety protocols going to be? There's no public statement on those details specifically yet either. Is testing going to be required? Are masks going to be required? Are vaccinations going to be required? Other questions, whatever the safety standards end up being, is there a demand sufficient to sell 90,000 tickets for WrestleMania on this short of notice and with immense travel restrictions? There'll be no international fans attending. You got to think consumers in general are hesitant still to attend large gatherings. Some are, some aren't. But regardless of how captivated and excited people are about the WrestleMania event, some are going to have hesitations about attending an event like this. Other fans who even do live in the United States may be in a more complicated situation if they live out of state and they have to go through inconvenient travel restrictions, or they may have to quarantine when they return back to their home state. It's very complicated if you're expecting to attract fans from outside of Florida. But I don't know. Do I think that there's 90,000 tickets to be sold here? Obviously, many people will attend both days. But I don't think, I would be surprised if this is a genuine sellout. I imagine we'll get some idea from WSEC filings or their key performance indicator documents that they publish after the fact. We've always been able to get an idea within a certain range of what the paid attendance was for WrestleMania going, I think, all the way back to 2008. I think we have that. And it helps that the Tampa Bay Sports Authority, Tampa Sports Authority, is overseeing this. They're a public organization, a government organization. So there may be some FOIA requests that can be done here as well. And I think there's some interesting questions going forward. What's the future of live events? And I'm not just talking about, maybe they won't run house shows, but what are venues and other authorities going to require eventually to be able to run events at full capacity? I've heard some speculation that, in major sports leagues that maybe, fans will be required to show some sort of proof that they've been vaccinated or something like that. Or that we may soon live in a world where everyone has a health passport that contains certain information verifying that you've been vaccinated or something. And just there's lots of other questions that I don't know the answer to. Can companies, wrestling companies or otherwise, require their workers' talent to be vaccinated?
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Or otherwise incentivize them to do so if, you don't have to go through contact tracing or you don't have to quarantine if you're vaccinated or something like that. I have started to do a survey, which has a very low sample rate, but it is through a Facebook ad, so hopefully it's somewhat random. But I've got a lot of responses here where I've asked wrestling fans, and when I say a lot of responses, I've got 23, but what I'm saying is the majority of them are saying either they definitely will not get vaccinated, probably won't get vaccinated, or are undecided. The majority. This was a survey. Is a survey directed at wrestling fans. Again, very low sample rate, so don't take that too seriously. But I wonder, are wrestling fans disproportionately averse to getting a COVID-19 vaccine? And how does that affect the future of live events, the return of live events, and things of that nature? Again, it's a Facebook ad, so hopefully these respondents are somewhat random. Maybe is there something about the pool of people that were receiving this ad, or the kinds of people who are willing to click on a ad that has a survey in it? Maybe there's something about that that tends to make one skew towards being skeptical of a vaccine. I don't know. So, but going forward, maybe I'll put some more money into the ad and we'll get some more responses. So this is actually something that's a little bit more reliable. These are all U.S. responses, by the way. In other news, there's an article on the Patreon, patreon.com/WrestleNomics. When NBC Universal and WWE announced about a week ago that the WWE Network will be moving over to Peacock on March 18th, WWE Network and Peacock will simultaneously carry WWE Network content from March 18th to April 4th. But beginning April 4th, Peacock, this is only in the U.S., by the way. If you're international, you're not in the U.S., this doesn't apply to you. 18th to April 4th, content will be on both the WWE Network and Peacock. Beginning April 4th, Peacock will be the only place to get WWE Network content in the U.S. Again, this doesn't affect you if you're outside of the U.S., but for the 70% or so of WWE Network subscribers in general who are in the U.S., this does affect you. After April 4th, your WWE Network will probably no longer work, and the only way to get it to work is through Peacock. I feel like I'm advertising here, which you can subscribe to for $4.99. It's at a lower rate than your $9.99 subscription. That is with ads, though. The ad-free subscription is $9.99. I've heard there's a $2.50 trial or something out there as well. But anyway, other important news there, though, is that not all of the current WWE Network content will be on Peacock immediately. The press release that WWE and NBC Universal put out said that it will take up to SummerSlam, or the language to be specific is by SummerSlam. The entire library will be there by SummerSlam. This, however, led to some panic among hardcore wrestling fans, worried that, well, maybe the library content, the older archives, the territory stuff, the indie stuff, the stuff that is less watched in all likelihood, Will that actually get moved over to such a mainstream service as NBC Universal's Peacock? Or will they just forget about that and, you know, put the major pay-per-views on there from WCW, ECW, put the Raw and SmackDown archives on there and just forget about the rest? A lot of concern about that, particularly in the Voices of Wrestling Slack. So I emailed Rick Cordell, who's the Executive Vice President and Chief Revenue Officer for Peacock TV. I believe he's also the person who negotiated the deal with Nick Khan of WWE to sell the rights to the content to NBC Universal. I asked him, and there was also some concern about maybe cycling the content, you know, how Netflix sort of, you know, puts a certain amount of stuff out there for a certain amount of time, then it goes away again. I think that really has to do with rights deals rather than voluntarily cycling things. But there was some speculation and concern as well that maybe not all of the content would be out there at once permanently, and that maybe some of it would get cycled in and out. So I was asking about the cycling aspect of the content, and I was asking about the library, including things like AWA, Jim Crockett Promotions, Mid-South, World Class. Is that stuff going to make it over to Peacock? Is there going to be cycling? Rick Cordella commented, quote, "We're going to put it all on Peacock. No cycling. It just takes time to re-encode all the hours. It's labor-intensive with the metadata, imagery, closed captioning, etc. The team has it as a top priority," end quote. So according to Rick Cordella, that will all happen. It may take until SummerSlam, which is in August, for it to happen. But it sounds like it's all going to go over. Unfortunately, though, it will be a few months before it is all over there. And by the way, it is clear, I don't know if I've said this as definitively in the past, but you will have to sign up manually for Peacock. There will be no automatic migration of W Network user accounts over to becoming Peacock user accounts. I believe your W Network user account will simply be canceled, I guess. That would be my guess. And if you want to resume access to W Network content after April 4th, you will have to manually sign up for Peacock. You can also watch Murder, She Wrote, though, on Peacock. According to the Sports Business Journal, the NHL has made a deal with ESPN for its A package. Looks like NHL is going to split the rights to its games between ESPN and another partner. Maybe its current partner, NBC Universal, we'll see. But at least some of those rights going to ESPN in a 7-year, $2.8 billion deal, which according to John O'Rand of the Sports Business Journal, quote, sheds a light on how the future of media deals will be structured, with streaming services getting even more play than linear TV, John O'Rand says. Part of the deal includes 75 exclusive games on ESPN Plus, that's a streaming service, and Hulu, another streaming service. That's right, live sports, exclusively on streaming services. We have arrived. These are not FANG streaming services. ESPN is owned by Disney. Hulu is owned partly by Disney and NBCU. 4 of the next 7 Stanley Cup finals will be on ABC, which Disney owns. ABC and ESPN will share a 25-game regular season package. But again, $2.8 billion over 7 years, that comes out to about $400 million a year for what looks to be just over 100 games a year. About 100 games a year for $400 million a year. Put that in some wrestling context, Raw is the biggest of the wrestling sports rights, with $265 million per year on an average annual basis for putting Raw on the USA Network with NBC Universal. But this looks to be just half of what the new deals are going to be for the NHL, which has another package of games to deal, perhaps to NBC Universal, maybe even Fox, who knows. And oh, this is important too. The NHL TV streaming service, which is basically a direct-to-consumer streaming service, I think, that moves to go within ESPN+. It will not be a separate deal anymore. Sounds something like the WWE Network being folded into Peacock. I wonder if there'll be automatic migration or not. Who knows? But maybe we are beginning to see, you know, the early stages of some of these things being rebundled, and Who knows how it will all play out in the end, but we've got a lot of direct-to-consumer services where the leagues, organizations like the NHL or WWE, they went direct-to-consumer at first, and it looks like, well, maybe it's more favorable for them to bundle up with larger media companies like ESPN Plus in the case of the NHL, or like NBC Universal with its Peacock service in the case of WWE. Well, I've looked around a bit, and I don't know what this $400 million per year from ESPN means compared to what the NHL's current deal is. Actually, I just looked it up. The current deal between NBCU and the NHL was $1.9 billion over 10 years. So that would be an average annual value of $190 million. So this ESPN deal alone, the NHL's new ESPN deal alone doubles what the NHL is getting from NBCU. Now, that was a very long-range deal that began in 2011. So maybe the NHL gets some sort of increase from NBCU as well and ends up, you know, maybe tripling or, who knows, even quadrupling its rights for its games. Why is this important? Why does this matter to a wrestling podcast? Because, again, we are coming up on the time in 2022 and 2023 when WWE and in all likelihood AEW will be renegotiating its TV rights deals. WWE's big TV deals come to an end in the fall of 2024, and those deals are expected to be renegotiated some year and a half before that term ends. AEW has a four-year deal, I think three years with a one-year option. If the option is picked up by Warner Media, then that would make that deal expire in December 2024, which would line the negotiation timeline up pretty closely with WWE's negotiating timeline. And again, why does this matter? Well, we're taking account of what the sports rights media market looks like. Is the bubble going to burst? It hasn't yet, and I'm skeptical that it ever will, as long as there is a lot of demand to watch live sports games and live wrestling. And as long as, you know, we look at you look at things like Raw, even though you can, I can make a tremendously sad line graph and get a lot of retweets and likes about it, charting the entire history of Raw and how ratings have declined tremendously. Nonetheless, if you look at, just to take an example, the last few weeks of Raw, look at Showbiz Daily on those Monday cable pages, and occupying the number one, number two, and number three slots are the, you know, first, second, and third hour of Raw. And SmackDown is doing pretty well also. Do you remember, by the way, when SmackDown's ratings were doing so bad that there were some commentators in the world of wrestling who were suggesting that maybe SmackDown would be kicked back to FS1? That's clearly not going to happen. It just looks to me that the sports rights market is strong, and what matters the most is what your viewership is compared to the wider selection of content that's out there. And again, I think the value for Raw is the threshold to whether it's going to become more or less valuable is the threshold between, is Raw ranking regularly in the top five as it is now, or does it start to fall below that? It has never, in the time that I've been following this over the last 5 years or so, it has never been out of that top five on a median basis or on an average basis. Yes, there are exceptional nights where there's a ton of news coverage or something like that where it gets bumped down, but normally it's in the top five. And you could say, you know, to a lesser extent, something similar about AEW on Wednesday nights. It's in lately, you know, the disappointing viewership this week for sure, but the ranking of AEW Dynamite has been in the top five on some weeks. And I think that supports an argument for a big increase for AEW Dynamite when its deal comes up, if all conditions that are what they are right now remain the same. NXT expiring in the fall of this year. NXT ranking number 25 this week, sometimes falling out of the top 50 in many weeks. What does that mean for its negotiations in the fall? We will see. Probably not huge money for NXT. What is NXT getting right now? I don't know. Somewhere in the wide range between $20 million and $50 million a year, I would guess. 2-year deal is coming to an end for NXT. Maybe it gets a mild raise. We'll see, or maybe it'll just happen and we won't get any detail about it. That's very possible. We'll see. I have a new article at WrestleOnyx.com, the final evaluation of the WWE Network. I think I have, yes, we did a podcast about this a couple weeks ago. So I'm not going to go into all this detail about it. And it's there's so much detail and so many numbers in it that it's really better to read it than it will be to listen to it in a podcast. But the long and short of it is, in this hypothetical scenario where the W Network doesn't launch, any number of scenarios could have been attempted, any number of strategies could have been attempted as an alternative. But it looks pretty clear that the network hasn't, at a minimum, the network has not been this transformative business strategy as it was promised to be, as it was advertised to be, this service that would capture 3 to 4 million subscribers worldwide. It's fallen substantially short of that. Is WWE more profitable because of the network? Maybe, but not by much. Maybe not even more profitable because of the network. The network in isolated years, yes, more profitable than pay-per-view, but there's a lot more to the story because the network cannibalized other businesses, including home entertainment, including digital media, that is, internet pay-per-view sales. The WWE Network, as I wrote about in a separate article, also had an adverse effect on WWE's ability to negotiate favorable TV rights fees in 2014. Did WWE offset that lack of value captured in its big increase, 3.6x increase in 2018? Was it all a wash? Who knows? But it's a very complicated and not overly positive story in terms of the financial picture. I think one of the key elements is that the network price point of $9.99 was just too low. I think WWE conceives of itself as more entertainment than sports, and that maybe contributed to a price point that was nearer to entertainment, scripted entertainment streaming services than sports streaming services, the out-of-market sports streaming services or TV packages like Red Zone for the NFL, NHL TV, MLB TV, I think NBA League Pass is, I think, the name of the NBA service. I think they underpriced it, and if the price was $15, I think the subscriber number would have been only slightly lower and would have captured a lot more revenue. And maybe you make the archival library a premium tier where that's even $20 for maybe 12 monthly pay-per-views, not including WrestleMania. WrestleMania remains a $60 exclusive a la carte purchase. That's my fantasy booking alternative scenario. And then if it doesn't work out, or if there is a great opportunity to sell the rights to a streaming service in the end, just as there was in reality to Peacock, then, well, you still have that option as well. But anyway, you can read, there's really two articles I'm referencing there. The final evaluation of the W Network, that is on WrestleNomics.com, as well as, what's the title of the other one? How the W Network's launch affected Raw and SmackDown rights negotiations. And by the way, we did get confirmation. I shared that article on LinkedIn, which contains the audio clip that I've played on this podcast a few times of Vince McMahon promising Brad Safalow that he could, an analyst, Brad Safalow, that he could put him in a hammerlock if they didn't at least double TV rights fees. Brad Safalow responding on LinkedIn to my post, saying that he still has not collected his hammerlock. So an update on that story from back in 2013. And we can talk about Google Web Search also for the months of January and February of this year. I have collected the data, and I tweeted it out at Brandon Thurston as well, if you want to see these tables. Does Google Web Search matter? I think it's a good predictor of consumer activity, and I think it's an indicator of mind share. How much are people thinking about a brand? Doesn't necessarily mean they're thinking about it in good ways, but how much are people thinking about a person, place, thing, whatever? So this goes back all the way to 2004. Anyway, January and February of this year, compared to last year, I think is a good comparison to make. So WWE worldwide is down 32% in January, down 14% in February. And again, just the support, why does this matter? Google web search started to decline in 2017 from 2016, and consumer metrics have, as I've often repeated, and as you can watch in a YouTube video that I will make public by the time this publishes, consumer metrics for WWE have been on the decline since 2016 or 2017, and Google web search, you could say, predicted that. It started to decline just before those metrics started to decline. So anyway, Google web search continuing to fall in consecutive years, it looks like, at least in these first 2 months of the year. That's on a worldwide basis. But it's down in the U.S. as well, down in January in the U.S. by 24%, down in February by 7%. But what about AEW? We've got a full year now in the year of 2020 to look back on. For the first time, we're able to make these year-over-year comparisons for AEW. AEW is down also, down by 8% worldwide in January, down 20% in February. In the U.S., it is exactly the same, down 8% January, down 20% February. Maybe you wanna argue that, well, we were still in the early months of the curiosity and interest in AEW. Maybe, but we will follow as the months go on. What about Impact Wrestling? After we've got a lot of red in this table since 2010 for Impact Wrestling, but in December 2020, up 57% in the month that Kenny Omega and AEW got involved with Impact. But in January, it was still down by 10%. I mean, this is worldwide. But then in February, back up by 29%. And sort of like when I talk about the 18 to 49 demo rating, we have numbers pretty close to zero that I'm dealing with. I could collect a smaller sample of time. I'm collecting all 15 or 16 years of history here. I could probably collect a smaller sample to get more precision here. But I think the is it positive or negative story is going to remain true. In the U.S., though, things are even better for Impact, where it was up 111% in December 2020, and then up 8% in January, up 44% in February. New Japan Pro Wrestling in January on a worldwide basis, down 8%, and in February, an even 0% difference for February. In February, we're going to be starting to compare 2021 to dormant pandemic months for New Japan. So these, I would expect these numbers for New Japan for March through July to be quite positive, just because they're being compared to times where there were no shows running at all for New Japan. This pandemic is really going to burn a hole in a lot of our ability to do year over year comparisons of various metrics, but that is what the supporters at patreon.com, patreon.com/WrestleNomics, pay the big bucks for. So I think that's all I have for this week. Again, I have a YouTube video that should be public by the time you're hearing this, with all of the great support that I've gotten from patreon.com/WrestleNomics, the patrons there. I am investing in Adobe Premiere, which is a video editing software, if you don't know. And I've created a short video that in under 5 minutes with visuals and the like, explaining how we can know with some confidence that WWE's popularity and at least its consumer metrics have declined a number of years in a row and before the pandemic and somewhat during it as well. So you can check that out on the WrestleNomics YouTube channel, probably shared across WrestleNomics social media as well. And you can support and become a patron. There's a lot of unlocked posts on there, some including the last week that have been posted. You also get access to a massive Google massive Google sheet, which is a spreadsheet that has over 14,000 points of data. Is the spreadsheet that I use that is a living document that has all of the wrestling viewership data that you hear referenced, that and well beyond, many tabs analyzing the data. Followed along with me, you get access to that by becoming a member at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. I have lowered, by the way, the background music in this program a little bit. Hopefully that's enough. I know there was some feedback that it was too loud at times. Actually, it was so low last week. That was just a mistake. But hopefully it's low enough now, and hopefully it is now optimal. You can let me know. If you want to hear me talk about actual in-ring wrestling, I was a guest with W.H. Park at Post Wrestling for his really great podcast series about All Japan and the Nannies, The Long and Winding Royal Road. I talked for, I think, almost 2 hours with W.H. Park about the December 6, 1996 Real World Tag League Final, the tag match between Jun Akiyama and Mitsuharu Misawa against Akira Tawai and Toshiaki Kawada, one of the all-time great tag matches. Again, that is the Long and Winding Royal Road on Post Wrestling. And there are some great episodes in there too, doing biographies for Mitsuharu Misawa and Toshiaki Kawada on an era of wrestling that is probably my favorite one of all time. But if you like this podcast, tell somebody about it. Make a post on it about social media. Do people still do iTunes reviews? You can do that too if you want. But thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. Again, you can read my written work at WrestleNomics.com. You can follow WrestleNomics at WrestleNomics. You can follow me at Brandon Thurston. I'm Brandon Thurston. I will talk to you next time.